The following is a recording of a USGS congressional briefing on the relationship between climate change and energy resources, given on July 27, 2007, at the Longworth House Office Building in Washington, D.C.
Good morning and welcome. Can everyone hear me okay? My name is Don Juckett. I'm director of the Office of Geoscience and Energy for the American Association of Petroleum Geologists. With your indulgence, I will refer to the association as AAPG because it's easier and quicker to say. I'm pleased to be here this morning and to be your host for this event. AAPG is the world's largest professional geological society with approximately 32,000 members worldwide. We have members in approximately 115 or 116 countries. This year marks the 90th anniversary of the association. We were founded in 1917. More than two-thirds of our members live and work in the U.S., more than 75% in North America. Included among our members are geologists, geophysicists, chief executive officers, managers, consultants, students, and academics. The purpose of AAPG is to foster the spirit of scientific research among its members and to advance science, the science of geology, particularly as it relates to petroleum, natural gas, other subsurface fluids, minerals, energy minerals, and the environment. You'll find on the table outside a one-page description of AAPG, which also has information about our website and other pertinent information. Special thanks go to the sponsors of today's meeting. That include Senator Jeff Bingaman, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Congressman Jim Moran of Virginia, Congressman Earl Blumenauer of Oregon, and Wayne Gilchrist of Maryland. Are any of those individuals here today? AAPG would like to add our thanks for allowing USGS to present this briefing today on climate change and energy mix. Climate change has been instrumental in shaping modern civilization as we know it. For example, climate change was likely responsible for the existence and the closing of the Alaska land bridge between Siberia and Alaska. That land bridge existed as recently as 11,000 years ago. Today, the area that was the land bridge lies beneath as much as 800 feet of water. And that body of water is known as the Bering Straits. Climate change continues to impact our lives, what cars we drive, what products are available to us, and in some cases, even where we choose to live. In the coming decades, climate change may significantly affect how we and the rest of the world choose to use energy resources. And as decision makers debate energy mix scenarios, climate change models, and response strategies, it is imperative that they have accurate information about national and global energy resources, both conventional and unconventional. Otherwise, the scenarios, models, and strategies may not be realistic or viable. USGS and its partners have been conducting scientific energy resource research and assessments for decades and will continue to provide the information needed by Congress and federal policymakers, and indeed, in many cases, the world, as they implement an energy mix that will help to ensure a healthy planet, a strong economy, and a secure nation for future generations. Today, we'd like to give you a little background on critical relationships between climate change and energy. Then we'll talk a bit about the work of the USGS as it's providing a foundation for realistic development of energy mix possibilities in the future. Then we'll wrap up with an introduction to one of the promising unconventional resources, gas hydrates, and how the USGS and the Department of Energy are working together to understand that resource. After our three speakers are done, there will be plenty of time for questions. I would ask that you please hold your questions until the end. Our first presenter this morning is Peter Schultz, Director of the Climate Change Science Program Office. I'm a former Fed, so I usually talk in four or five-letter acronyms, and we'll do a little bit of that. Peter will set the stage for what we know about potential impacts of climate change. Peter joined CCSPO in 2004 as Associate Director for Science Integration and now manages the program-wide scientific integration, planning, prioritization, and assessment activities through coordination with CCSP, directors, principals, interagency working groups. He spent several years at the National Academies where he directed scientific studies related to global environment variability and change. He also worked at NOAA's Climate Analysis Center on global scale remote sensing of vegetation. Peter holds a master's and a PhD in the geosciences from Penn State and a BS in geology from Virginia Tech. Peter?
All right, well, thanks for having me here. What I'm going to do is describe a little bit about what the Climate Change Science Program is, how we relate to USGS and the activities that are the topic of discussion today, what some of the findings are that have come out of the Climate Change Science Program, both domestically through some of our reports, some of the reports that USGS has led, and also internationally through a process called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which has just released a couple of state-of-the-art consensus reports. So let's have the first slide here. So the vision of the program is a nation and the global community empowered with the science-based knowledge to make wise decisions in the face of global environmental variability and change. And we do this through a program of observations, research, decision support, and communications. There are 13 agencies that make up the Climate Change Science Program. USGS is one, the Department of Energy is another. And we work to create a whole that's greater than the sum of the parts, that transcends the individual missions of each of the agencies to work really in the nation's interests around this issue. So let's have the next slide. Okay, so one of the things that the program has contributed to quite significantly is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the development of the statements of scientific consensus that exist in this. And one of the prominent conclusions that came out of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, the Working Group 1 report, was that the warming of the climate system is unequivocal. And in the bottom left-hand corner here, you see these are maps, and in the back you probably can't see what this is, but these are years ticking by, and they start in the late 1800s and go through the present. We're back in the late 1800s here, and what they are departures from the long-term average. And so the blue colors represent cooler than average temperatures, and the reds represent warmer than average temperatures. And you see that the Earth basically warms over the last 100 years. And you'll see as we come into the 2000s that it becomes quite warm here. We're now in 2000, 2006, and we go back to the beginning. The IPCC also concluded that most of the observed warming in the last couple of decades is very likely due to the increase in greenhouse gases. And the most important of those is carbon dioxide. And in the bottom right-hand corner, we have the so-called Keeling curve, a set of observations that are made of atmospheric carbon dioxide. And this chart goes from about 1957, 1958. So let's have the next slide. Okay. So the effects are not just being felt in terms of temperature. It's the whole Earth system that's being affected. And this is a fundamental conclusion from the IPCC process. In the bottom left-hand corner, what I'm showing you here is it's a remote sense image of vegetation. In the oceans, you have the algae. On land, you have trees, plants, shrubs, etc. And what you're seeing is the annual cycle just rapidly going through. And one of the observations that we've made through careful analysis of these data is that springtime is coming a little bit earlier in large parts of the Earth. It's by up to 2 weeks earlier in many places. In the bottom right corner, this is an image of sea ice extent going from 1979 to the present, we're probably in about the mid-80s now, there's been a significant reduction in sea ice coverage over the last 30 years or so. I could show you many other examples, but for the sake of brevity, we'll just move on to the next slide. Okay, so those were international consensus reports. The Climate Change Science Program has embarked on a process where we are producing 21 different synthesis and assessment products. Actually, there are 22 reports because one product has two reports coming out of it, and it's actually this product. I'm going to talk a little bit about this one in just a second because it pertains directly to the topics that we're addressing today. And USGS is a significant contributor among several other agencies to this process, which is complementary to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, but focused really on issues that are specific to the United States or that address issues that aren't being tackled by the IPCC. So let's look at the next slide. Okay, so one of the products that USGS is leading is a statement of scientific consensus on Arctic climate change, bringing to bear, in particular, some of the unique resources that USGS has to address Arctic climate change. Let's go to the next. Abrupt climate change, which I understand is a topic of the follow-on to this seminar. And I don't know what the timing of that will be, but I understand that's the next in the series. USGS is also leading this. The image that I have up here is of a couple of glaciers in the Pacific Northwest, and USGS has an important program in which they're monitoring some pretty rapid changes that are occurring in these systems. There are many other types of systems that this report will be looking at, and this is something that we really care about because often it's the rate of change that's more important than the magnitude of the change, because if the rate of change is quicker than the rate at which we're able to make new investments in infrastructure and the like, it can really be much more costly. So an improved understanding of abrupt climate change, particularly looking back retrospectively into the past, can really help us make some wise decisions moving out into the future. Then the next slide, USGS is also leading a synthesis and assessment product looking at thresholds of changing ecosystems. So even if we had a nice, slow, warming, well, not that it would necessarily be nice, but a slow, gradual warming that didn't have abrupt changes in it, there is still the potential for rapid changes in a variety of systems that we care about, including ecosystems. And this report is addressing that. An example of this is the pine bark beetle infestation that's going on right now in the U.S. West. And we're seeing that as a consequence of the drought that's existed there for many years. That then is affecting the forest stocks, which is increasing their vulnerability to forest fire, and it is increasing the potential for very large fires in the U.S. West. And so it's these kinds of abrupt kind of snowballing effects that this report is taking a look at. Let's go on to the next slide. Many other areas that USGS is leading in partnership with the other CCSP agencies. In particular, water resources, which I understand was the topic of the preceding seminar, landscape change, sediment dynamics, really important contributions to our understanding of geological sequestration, that is, taking carbon dioxide that would have otherwise gone into the atmosphere and putting it underground, and looking at the potential for doing that. And I'll come back to that. And also understanding where the carbon dioxide goes that we emit into the atmosphere. And also identifying hydrocarbon repositories. And it's really important for us to have an advanced understanding of this because the type of hydrocarbons, the type of fossil fuels that we burn have significant implications for climate. So for instance, depending on what the sulfur content of the fuels is, that affects the extent to which you would get acid rain, the extent to which you would get sulfate aerosols, these tiny particles in the atmosphere that can change the reflectivity of the planet and thereby change the climate system. So improving understanding of what's out there, what the capacities are in terms of fossil fuel mixes is absolutely vital, and USGS is making an important contribution to that. This is one of my favorite images. USGS produces maps on a routine basis in terms of water resources. This is a depiction of current stream flow reds are below normal, the blues and purples are above normal stream flow, and you can just click on any of these things and see what the current stream flow is for an area that you're interested in. I'm a kayaker, so I use this resource quite a bit. It's my personal life. Go to the next slide. Okay, the IPCC concluded that a portfolio of adaptation and mitigation is needed to diminish the risks associated with climate change, and went on to say that there is significant economic potential for doing this. We picked up this in one of our synthesis and assessment products, and it's actually led by the Department of Energy, where we took three leading what are called integrated assessment models. They integrate many different factors associated with coping with climate change, put them all into these models and run some scenarios. And the scenarios that we looked at were stabilization at different levels, 450 parts per million of CO2 up to 750 parts per million of CO2. The pre-industrial level was about 280. So what I'm showing here are stabilization scenarios that essentially double the carbon dioxide concentration. And in order to stabilize at something like a doubled level, you need to act fairly aggressively in terms of changing the ways that we produce energy. And these three models present three plausible scenarios for doing that. These aren't predictions, they're just projections that say, given what we know and given what the assumptions are in these various models, these are ways of achieving it. The gray bars here are conservation. This is just simply reducing the amount that's emitted. So this is the amount of energy produced. This is time here, so 2,000 up to 2,100. And I won't get into explaining what each of the colors means, but I'll give one example here that pertains to the subject today. Carbon capture and storage is all of these hatched areas in the, for example, in the purple. So this is coal production, it's the purple. And purple, and the hatched purple, is the amount of carbon capture and storage that would have to occur to reach this target, to stabilize this target. So what that means, carbon capture and storage, is if you have a coal-fired power plant, you're scrubbing out the CO2 and you're pumping it underground. That's the likely way that would play out. And so some of these scenarios rely heavily on that type of thing. And the work that's happening within USGS and other CCSP partner agencies and understanding how that can be done, what the economically efficient ways of achieving those sorts of things are vital contributions to the program. Let's have the next slide. Okay, so achieving those stabilization scenarios comes at a cost. And this report that we produced, it just came out this month, says if you are working toward a certain scenario, working towards a certain target, here are what some of the costs would be in some of the things we care about: crude oil, regular gasoline, heating oil, wellhead gas, residential gas, electricity. This is just at a, what I'm showing here is an illustrative chart for if the price of carbon went up to $100 per ton. And that's, I won't get into the details of what the pricing would be according to these models to reach those targets, but the point of showing this is that this plays out in a variety of areas on things that we care about. And improving the scientific understanding is absolutely essential so that we can reduce the economic costs of dealing seriously and aggressively with this issue. And I think that's the last slide. Let's see. Yes, it is. So with that, I'll turn it back to our chair.
Thank you, Peter. Our second speaker this morning is Brenda Pierce, who's program coordinator for the USGS Energy Resources Program. Brenda manages domestic and international USGS research on oil, gas, coal, coal bed methane, natural gas hydrates, geothermal, uranium, and oil shale. Boy, that must make her a pretty important person. And the environmental impacts of energy occurrence and use. Before joining the Energy Resources Program, Brenda was project chief of the USGS National Coal Resource Assessment. She also led an international USAID-funded program to explore for and assess coal resources in the former Soviet Union. Her primary area of expertise is organic petrology, with an emphasis on coal geology, in coal quality. It means she spent a lot of time looking down a microscope at these little pieces of coal. She has led or has been part of research teams studying coal bed methane, predicting coal quality, reconstructing depositional environments, predicting acid mine drainage, and studying the geology and quality of coals around the world. Please welcome Brenda Pierce.
Thank you, Don, and thank you, Peter, for setting the stage. That was great. The next slide. I want to just take a few moments before we launch into USGS research and further set the stage, adding to what Peter said, about why climate change and energy actually is linked. These are scenarios and forecasts from the International Energy Agency and the Energy Information Administration. And we all know that they do various forecasts and have different assumptions in them. The assumptions are based upon different economic models, upon different carbon capture models. But the point here is that every single one of them, high economic, low carbon capture, high carbon capture, all of them increase. They all show carbon emissions globally increasing in the past, but all forecasted for the future. You can offset that depending upon your assumptions, but they all show that we're going up. And I want to show the carbon emissions comparing from 1973 to 2004. This is on a global scale. The real numbers are here. They're almost doubling, not quite. They're almost doubling. And these are the proportions of the parts of the world that are contributing to that. The OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, of which the U.S. is part, is certainly the lion's share. This smaller piece of the pie does not mean that the true emissions of the OECD is lessening. It just means that the percentage is lessening because other percentages in parts of the world are increasing. So things like China, which was almost 6% in 1973, is almost 18% now in 2004. Asia, exclusive of China, has also grown considerably, as has other parts of the world. So I just give these statistics because we have to look at this in a global context. These are very important issues. It's not just the U.S., it's globally. Next slide. There are many sectors to the energy area, electrical, transportation, et cetera. And I just want to take one of those to illustrate to you that there is energy mix and it's important. This is electrical generation. The top chart is the United States. And again, it's a comparison figure between 1975 and 2004. So in the 70s, coal was a significant part of the electrical generation in the United States, but less than half, at 44%. It is now over 50%, as most of us know. But if you look at the other constituents of the electrical generation capacity of the United States, petroleum was more than 15% in the 70s, and it's just but a tiny sliver, and that's because it's such an expensive commodity and used for many other things. The hydroelectric is less than half of what it was in the 70s as well. There's environmental concerns, there's a lot of reasons for that, but hydroelectric is less than half. What has taken up the slack to the most part is nuclear in the United States, surprising to many people. Percentage-wise or kilowatt-wise, we're the largest nuclear producer in the whole world. And natural gas has stayed about the same between those time periods. Looking at this on a global scale, though, again, putting in a perspective from the world, same type of timing distribution, 1973 to 2004, coal has stayed pretty much stable around the world at a little over, almost 40%. But the oil and hydro show the same trends, and oil has gone from almost a quarter to a fraction for those very reasons. Economic, it's used for other things. Hydro around the world has also lessened, but both natural gas and uranium has picked up that slack for around the world. Next slide. And so energy consumption by every sector is projected to go up, and we all know that. But every forecast in the world, not only do carbon dioxide emissions go up, but energy consumption. As GDP increases, energy demand increases. As we all become more technologized, whatever that word is, all of our demands are going to go up. And these are our realities. This is what we're going to have to deal with. So we need to understand what our demand might increase, what might be some of the realities of fuel switching, those types of things. And to put this in perspective, we're going to need more energy in the U.S. and around the world. Next slide. So I threw this in partly because I think it's a very cool figure. But what this is the NASA Earth at Night figure, and it shows electrical consumption, but that goes hand in hand with transportation consumption, energy consumption around the world. And what we've done is overlay this with the USGS World Petroleum Assessment. And so oil in green and gas in red. And what this shows is the USGS looks at undiscovered resources. So these are not resources that are currently in usage or being produced. These are resources that are out there, potentially out there, and have the potential to be added to reserves. And so a couple points to think about in the rest of the talk is that where major resources occur is not where they're being consumed. So we have to look at energy on a global scale. There's a give and take here. And the other point to think about is that at least for conventional petroleum, a lot of these hugely potential future resources lie in climate-sensitive areas. So we need to understand all this and put it in a context of some of the choices that we're going to make. Next slide. So what does the USGS do to help in all of these difficult situations, difficult choices, the myriad of information that's out there? And there's a lot of other energy groups out there as well. Well, we're the sole provider of some of the basic information on all geologically based energy resources, as Don said. We study coal, oil, natural gas, coal bed methane, methane hydrates, geothermal, heavy oil, et cetera. So we look at the geologically based resources. And this we conduct research on them and assessment. And this energy information can be used for natural resource security, viable and realistic energy mix scenarios, which can all feed into climate change models. Everyone, the public, policymakers, scientists, we all care about the fundamentals of energy. We care about its availability, its reliability, its cost, and its environmental impact. And we need to keep all of those things in mind. Every energy resource has an environmental cost. It has a real cost. The questions boil down to where the energy occurs, the quality of that commodity, the cost of that commodity, the impact of using it, and then what mixes are there, what mixes are here now, what mixes might be available in the future. A lot of it's geologic, a lot of it's technology that can develop in other energy resources, but you need to have a basic understanding of what's there, where it is, its quality. So understanding the resources can help with these climate change questions of what efficiencies will be needed in the future, because what are our energy resources of the future? What preventative strategies need to be undertaken to meet whatever targets are agreed upon? What mitigation strategies then will also need to be implemented? How far are we and what is there? And what renewables can be added to the mix? Basically, what is realistic? Are we implementing the right strategies for what energy mix we have? Just a little bit of detail, I'm not going to go into it a lot, of what we do. This is a natural gas hydrate well that we drilled. We didn't drill it. We worked jointly with the Department of Energy and BP on the North Slope last February, and our next speaker, Ray Boswell, will talk much more about hydrates. But USGS conducts research on truly unconventional resources. We do this for a variety of reasons, but we're trying to help move some of these unconventional resources into the conventional realm with our partners. We look at underutilized resources like geothermal to either use them better or understand our geology more so that we can use them in a wider aspect in the United States. And we look at other unconventionals as well, coal bed methane, tight gas sands. This is the fastest growing petroleum resource development in the United States, and it's virtually untouched around the world, partly because it's been very difficult to develop and the geologic understanding is only evolving now. Next slide. So we produce assessments of these undiscovered resources. We're the only group that does undiscovered resources, and the reason we do this is you need to know where the potential lies ahead of where it's being developed now. So this is the United States. We look at it both in detail and nationally. Next slide. As well as globally. I mentioned before we have a World Petroleum Assessment. These are only conventional resources. We hope to get to unconventional in the future, but we've looked at unconventional resources around the world. We also have research projects on things like reserve growth. Reserve growth happens that when you have a field that's being developed, reserves actually grow because our geologic understanding grows, technology changes, and you can actually get more out of a field than was originally thought. We look at all these studies and our assessments, and we do them globally. And I just want to point out that when we did our resource assessment, our global resource assessment, we pretty much excluded the Arctic because of lack of data, high-risk area. It was very difficult to look at. So when we finished this, what we've done is concentrate only on the Arctic for the last couple of years. We've done this because it is a high-risk area of great uncertainty. But because it also is an area of high resource potential, we felt it was critical to focus on the Arctic for the resource potential, put it in context of the rest of the world, so we can put it in a context that is comparable to everywhere else, to look at what's realistic, what's not. Areas of no potential is as important as areas of potential. And we're starting to release these in the fall, and over the next year, we will actually have the whole circumarctic done in a consistent, holistic way. Next slide. And so this is just an example of putting our work into context and maybe a derivative product. So again, this is our world petroleum assessment. This is conventional oil and gas resources. And again, these are undiscovered, and the resources that have the potential to be added to reserves. And what you might do with this is look at areas of sensitivity, of not sensitivity. You might compare it to areas of current production and where is current production, future production makes sense. So again, here's a comparison slide of 1973 to 2005. And you actually look for terms of percentages, Middle East has actually declined over that time period. Other areas like South America and Africa have actually increased to displace some of those things. So you can compare and contrast some of these things, looking at it on a global scale. And our next speaker, Ray Boswell, who's going to talk about hydrates, you can do this kind of information on any type of commodity, and we should be looking at these on any type of commodity. But if you produced a map like this on gas hydrates, it would pretty much look very different, with one or two exceptions. And so thinking about that, can we make hydrates a part of a realistic energy mix? It's going to change geopolitics, it's going to change economics, it's going to change a lot. And as a lot of people think, as natural gas is the bridge to a renewable economy or whatever is in the next 40 to 50 years, if we can make hydrates a producible resource, a lot of these things are going to change. So again, I just put the plug in for a global perspective. All of these energy resources come at a cost. We all have environmental concerns, and we need to look at them holistically from the very beginning to the end with each other, and hopefully we provide the information for that. I have to turn it over to Ray.
Thank you, Brenda. I'm going to digress here for just a moment. The National Petroleum Council, which is an advisory body, a federal advisory body to the Secretary of Energy, just completed and issued a study requested by the Secretary of Energy. And that study issued, I believe, on the 18th of this month. The reason I'd like to highlight that study is because the tasking that the Secretary had given the advisory committee was to look at the next 25 to 35 years of energy availability, particularly petroleum, oil, and gas, on a global basis. And as the study participants move forward in looking at the global endowment, one of the things that rapidly became apparent to the study participants, and this is industry, government, NGOs, full spectrum of people, academics, was that the singular source of global oil and gas resource information that had credibility and served as a primary source of information was the USGS Global Resource Assessment for Oil and Natural Gas. And so while I'm putting in a plug for that, it is widely recognized that part of the GS's program is unique in assessing global resources. So if you'll forgive me my digression. Our final speaker today is Ray Boswell. Ray currently manages the field implementation of the Department of Energy's Research and Development Program in Natural Gas Hydrates from the NETL Laboratory in Morgantown, West Virginia. He chairs an interagency group representing seven agencies, which has recently authored a long-range and near-term roadmap for determining gas hydrates, resource potential, and role in the natural gas environment. And the role in natural environment, excuse me. Ray received his bachelor's degree in geology from the College of William and Mary and a master's and PhD in stratigraphy and sedimentology from West Virginia University. Ray?
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be invited here. Thanks to those who invited me. It's a fascinating topic. It's one I've been was introduced to 3 years ago after spending most of my career in conventional and tight gas resources. This is truly an unconventional resource. There's so much we don't know about gas hydrates, but it has so much potential, so many far-reaching implications for so many areas of science that people all over the globe are getting very excited about gas hydrates. Can you go to the next slide? Just to sort of set the stage, I suspect a lot of people here might not know what gas hydrates are. There's one very simple phase transition in chemistry that we think we all understand, and that's when water passes 32 degrees centigrade and turns into ice. So you go from liquid to a solid, but it's really not that simple. Actually, what happens is there's this transition period where it starts to form the ice lattice, but you have these open voids. And if there are gases in the environment that can go and fill those voids, it will fill those voids and arrest the further compaction of the water into the ice that we know. And what you end up with is a solid that has a lot of the properties of ice. Here's a big chunk of it, a pipeline, it's about a foot across. But it contains enormous amounts of methane. 1 cubic meter of that solid would release 164 cubic meters of gas. It's a very efficient means of storing gas. And it was first created in a lab back in the 1800s, and until about the 1930s, most people thought it was only something that existed in laboratories. It was a curiosity, something people fiddled around with. Then they started to find it in natural gas pipelines. A lot of research was being done then, still thought it was something that only was created by man-made action. Then, around 1980, the Glomar Challenger was on one of its deep-sea drilling programs and pulled up a big chunk, a meter-thick, solid methane hydrate from offshore Costa Rica. And then people started to wonder, this thing actually could exist in the natural environment? For the next decade, the Department of Energy had a program. We spent about $8 million, but USGS did most of the heavy lifting in documenting the occurrence of gas hydrates in nature. They showed that it exists in abundance in Alaska. A very famous diagram produced by USGS ended up showing that gas hydrates probably could contain more total organic carbon than all the other known natural storehouses of organic carbon combined, including fossil fuels, soil, water, plants, animals. So that is a major change in the way we thought about organic carbon on the planet, where it is housed, how it moves around. A lot of countries saw that. A lot of people got excited about it. In 2000, Congress passed the Methane Hydrate Research and Development Act, which charged the Department of Energy to work with seven other federal agencies to find out about methane hydrates, what it means for the global environment, what it means for potential energy resources. Next slide, please. Okay. This is an area of R&D where I think we can all agree there's a very clear federal role. This is long-term research, high risk. We're right at the beginning of a new science, basically, with a very high potential payoff. It's also expanding international R&D. And one of the more fascinating things about methane hydrates is it's extremely multidisciplinary. In my job, I deal with microbiologists, geophysicists, physicists, chemists, biologists, oceanographers, everybody, right? Geologists. Everybody has something to contribute to this, and they all need to be brought together into a cohesive program. There are a wide range of public interest issues that derive from methane hydrates. So now that we have got this general consensus that there's a global natural gas resource housed in hydrates in the natural environment, raises a lot of issues. One major issue is its role in nature. What does this methane hydrate mean to deep sea ecosystems? What does it mean to its impact on the stability of continental shells and sediment, its contribution to massive wasting, seafloor slide, slumps on the continental shelf? What does it mean to our basic understanding of the carbon cycle? and then what does it mean for our understanding of global climate? All of this, a lot of basic science has to be done to assess how much gas hydrate exists, how it exists, where it exists. All that information needs to be rolled into a cohesive story to determine hydrate role in nature. What has a lot of people very excited, and Brenda talked about this, is its potential economic significance. One issue is, does it create a hazard for ongoing oil and gas exploration in deep water? But what has most people excited is its future energy potential. Gas hydrates exist throughout the world. It is not concentrated in specific areas. A lot of countries who are right now resource starved are very interested in seeing if hydrates can be a source of increased energy security for them. So the DOE program is charged with conducting the science and technology development to answer these questions. We'll go to the next one. So what is the USGS's contribution to this? Well, it's huge. This gas hydrate program is unique in the portfolio of the organization I work for. Our job is typically technology development. We work to take tools and devices and procedures that are on the edge of commercialization and showing people how they can be used. Methane hydrates, however, we're very early. There's so much that we don't know. There's a huge science component to this. And for the first 7 years into this program now, the USGS has been the DOE program source for credible, reliable, and objective science information. This is something that DOE doesn't have. We do have that, of course. This is something that we do not have the resources internally in DOE to conduct this science. Neither do our industrial partners that we tend to work with. They don't have a staff of microbiologists. They don't have a staff of people in physical chemistry. They don't have all those people who we can bring into the program to advance this science. USGS has also been a valued partner in creating a national R&D program. What the Act said was, we don't want DOE to run this program. We want this to be a multi-agency program, 7 federal agencies. I won't name them. USGS is one of them. But USGS's support for the planning and scoping of the mission of this program has been really key to get all these groups on one page and to develop a consensus view in the science community of what needs to be done and when and in what order and in what magnitude. And we do have that now. We have all these agencies agreeing that this is what we need to do, and we need to do this first and this second, and USGS's support into that process has been critical in developing. As a result of this, our gas hydrate program, we will not do a major field program. We will not change an emphasis without getting buy-in from all those agencies, and most particularly the USGS. Okay. Next slide, please. So in addition to the contribution USGS has had in planning the program and setting the priorities for the program, they are also a very valuable resource in us executing what we want to do. What the Department of Energy typically does is we will form cooperative agreements with industry partners. We supply money, they supply expertise and data. And then we conduct a series of experiments in the lab and then primarily leading to big field programs. We have 2 major field programs going on now, one in the Arctic and in northern Alaska, one in the Gulf of Mexico. DOE is a USGS is a primary contributor to the development of the plans, the activities, and the implementation of those acts in the field. One I want to talk about particularly is our recent well, our gas hydrate exploration well in North Slope of Alaska. It's the first gas hydrate dedicated exploratory well in the North Slope since 1972. And it was a spectacular success for everybody involved. The well achieved all of its objectives. The USGS had estimated in advance what we were going to find and helped us pick the location. We drilled the well. We found hydrates where we thought we would find. We found as much hydrates as we thought we would find. We safely collected them, brought them to the surface, and we have shipped them to labs all over the country for study. And we couldn't have done that without the USGS. And here's Dr. Tim Collette, and he was the man who ran the show on the ground up there from the USGS. And that might be me in the background. And so that well
create a lot of scientific firsts and a lot of new data that's helping to advance gasified drinks as we go forward. USGS is also very fundamental in leading the experimental effort in the labs and the numerical simulation efforts that we have for developing models to predict how gasified behavior may be. So very important contributor to us executing our programs in the field. Next, please. Now, I mentioned before there's a lot of interest internationally in gas hydrates. Right now, the DOE program has been funded in gas hydrates at about $12 million a year. Last year, the Indian government probably spent three or four times that. The Japanese government probably spent six or seven times that. The Korean government is planning to spend multiple times what we spent. The Chinese government just completed an expedition. A lot of people are outspending us. We need to be very smart to keep ahead and stay the leaders in this new science and technology development program. USGS has been critical, and one of the ways that we're going to be able to do that is by tapping in and leveraging this international R&D that's going on. USGS has been critical in keeping our national program integrated into those international efforts. They were instrumental in creating the first cooperative program with Japan and helping to organize and run international ocean drilling program expeditions that are co-funded by Japan, the European Union, and the U.S. But most notably, when the Indian government set out to do their huge expedition in the Indian Ocean last year, they specifically went to the USGS and said, we want you guys to run this program. You're the recognized leaders in this science. And so you guys did. And it was a spectacular success. They collected more data on gas hydrates in that expedition than had been achieved in the prior 10 years of gas hydrates study. They drilled, I think, 32 holes in 21 sites and have sent samples all over the world. Samples have gone to Germany and England and Canada and the U.S. And this is largely because foreign programs recognize the U.S. capabilities, and particularly the USGS's leadership in gas hydrates. The USGS has been very helpful in helping us other organizations that are a little newer to it to gain our expertise and get involved with these programs. And it's also just helped the U.S. R&D dollar go a lot farther. So I think that's about what I want to say. Thank you. And now we turn it back to Don.
Thank you, Ray. Please join me in thanking all three of our speakers.
Thank you for listening to a USGS Corecast. For complete transcripts or more information, visit internal.usgs.gov and click Corecast channel in the upper right-hand corner. Corecast is a product of the U.S. Geological Survey, Department of the Interior.